Okay. As Saji said earlier, we're now on to week four of the actual teachings, week five of the series of fruitfulness on the front line. How are you fruitful wherever you are and whatever you're doing? Whether that's working in the hospital, being a doctor, being a teacher, or simply doing the gardening, chatting to people over the fence and having your friends round for a cup of tea or something stronger. So we start with Matthew 5. You are the salt of the earth, Jesus said. What does that mean? And, sorry, could the lectern be raised a tiny little bit? It's a little bit low.
I can do it,
yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Thank you very much. No, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine. You can stop it there. Yeah. Okay. Salt in those days was valuable. It was far more valuable then than it is now because it was needed to keep your food from going horrible. It was really important that in the winter you bought bags of salt so you could kill your pigs, you could kill your cows, you could kill your sheep, you could kill your goats, you could salt the meat down, and that way it wouldn't go horrible during the winter and you could eat. It does also make the meat taste horrible because it's salted and dried, but that's better than starving. So if you bought salt, salt kept you going. But, says Jesus, if the salt stops being salty, what's the point of it? Well, there's no point to it. That's the answer. You throw it out, you trample over it, you can't use it. It's gone. It's useless. Jesus is saying to his people, to the disciples, you are the salt of the earth. You are what makes the world better. You preserve the world that we live in. In the same way, we are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Why use that example? Because Jesus is saying we have to stand out. We often have this idea that as Christians, you're meant to be meek. Yes, that's true. You're not meant to make a big show of things or of yourselves. Yes, that's true as well. But you are not supposed to cocoon yourself in a church, even though that's very tempting, where the world can't see you, on the grounds that we don't live in a very nice culture. That is why Jesus says, a city on a hill cannot be hidden. You put a city on a hill for one reason, so it could be defended if it was attacked. In fact, when Jesus is talking about the city on the hill, his listeners probably thought he was talking about Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a city on the top of an enormous hill. If you go to Jerusalem nowadays, when you've arrived at Israel's airport and turned onto the right road, you have to drive up an enormous gorge called the Ba'el Wad. And as you go up it, your ears might very easily pop because you're going higher and higher and higher and higher. And right at the top of the Ba'el Wad is the city of Jerusalem. Everyone can see it. Jesus says everyone should be able to see you. That's not a very nice thought, actually, because there are some bits of me I don't want anyone seeing. I'm sure we'd all agree there are some bits of us we don't want anyone seeing. But if we are truly to be Jesus' followers, we need to be seen in the culture in which we lived and in which we live now. That is why Jesus calls us to be salt of the earth, light of the world. You don't light a lamp and put it under a bowl, says Jesus, because if you do that, you've hidden it. No one can see it. What's the point in doing that? You put it on its stand, of course, when you light the lamp, because it's dark, and then everybody in the house can see everything. Why is this so important to Jesus? Very often, preachers will give you this idea that preaching the gospel is essential. Oh, it is. No one's denying that. But it often goes to the idea of preaching the gospel is more important than going to work. Preaching the gospel is more important than climate change. Preaching the gospel is more important than looking after the family. If you're preaching the gospel, Jesus will forgive you. Some of them even go further than that and say preaching the gospel is the only thing that's important. Going to work isn't important. Looking after the family isn't important. Preaching the gospel is important. Now that's an extreme example, but if you have been, those of us who've been in St Mark's Church for a good while and heard our last vicar, Peter Guinness, preaching on this, he would always say that in Jewish culture, everything you did was important to God. There is no gap between what you do every day and preaching the gospel. One of those things isn't more important than the other. They're both important to God because everything you do shows him to other people. That is why we're called to mould culture. How you behave comes out in how other people behave. How you behave affects culture. You swear because everybody swears. Well, that's just normal, isn't it? Come on, everyone does it. What are you making such a fuss about? What do you mean I should say sorry instead of blaming someone else for my problems? Everyone blames somebody else. That's just normal. Yeah, I am pushing hard to get my own way and to become important and to get the top job in my company. Everyone wants the top job. Everybody does that. What does it matter if I'm trampling on other people in my wake? Everybody does it. That is what Jesus wants us to change. And it's changed by the way we behave. It doesn't matter if you're in a school, if you're in government, if you're chatting to people over the fence, how you behave is important. Do you gossip? Everyone gossips, but is that a good thing? Do you teach your children they need to apologize and they need to listen? Maybe other people don't teach their children that, but if you teach them that, how big a difference will that make? And it also means people will see you. They will see our good deeds and know there is something different about what we do and who we are. Last week, Sadhu shared with us that the Good Samaritan story is important because the church is the half-dead man and the Good Samaritan at the same time. Half-dead man because we know it's not us who does the work, it's Jesus. It shouldn't be our good deeds because we're good. It's our good deeds because God shows us what he's like and gives us the power to do the same. But it's his power, not our power. And we're the Good Samaritan because we're called to be completely countercultural sometimes, to do things differently. That could actually mean going up to somebody and saying, I'm sorry for what I said about you. I'm sorry for that email. It was unreasonable. It wasn't right. And there is no way I can justify it. How often do we hear someone actually say in Parliament, I am truly sorry? Usually it's something along the lines of, I deeply regret what I did. Yes, they do, but they're not saying, I'm sorry for it. They're saying, I regret doing it. It's a standard saying, but we rarely hear the word sorry used. And it's a word we could do with hearing more. So now we've got done all that, let's move on to the second reading. Now you may be wondering, why on earth did David choose to do the story of Joseph in the famine? What's the significance of that? Just to tell the story very briefly again, Joseph has been taking the money in Egypt in payment for grain because Egypt has a famine going on. When the money runs out, he takes their animals because there's no point in them using animals if they can't feed them or themselves and can't plough their fields. And when the animals run out, he makes them into slaves, more or less. Now, politically, that's not very correct, certainly not in the 21st century. And you may wonder, why did Joseph do that? Because in those days, the only possible way that he could help them was by taking their land and getting them to plant it. There was no other way that he could give them food. He couldn't just give it to them, but he couldn't watch them starve. And as a result, Egypt changed dramatically. Pharaoh was actually the king of Egypt, of all Egypt, and all the subjects who couldn't eat were being fed because they were Pharaoh's responsibility, Pharaoh's lands, Pharaoh's people, therefore it was his responsibility to give them food. Okay, that's not very correct to our 21st century ears, but not only was it the only way, but it's pretty amazing as well when you look at it. Joseph let them keep a fifth, 4/5 of everything. Pharaoh only took a fifth. In most feudal societies where the lord ran things, he would demand half from you, if not more. If you went to fight and you won a great victory, he would demand half of everybody's plunder. And being a lord, he'd probably take the best bit. And you got to keep the rest. And if you argued, well, you wouldn't argue. Not unless you fancied having your head cut off. In a feudal society where the lord can take whatever he wants and as much as he wants, and he might even take all of it if he was feeling really mean, Joseph lets them have 1/5 of everything. So he lets Pharaoh have 1/5. They keep everything else themselves. It's a pretty good deal, and it's a sign of culture being moulded that's not actually a very nice culture. Often we believe that this Pharaoh was quite a benign, quite a nice, quite a wise man who gave Joseph a good position because he saw Joseph was very competent. Some of that's true. He did see Joseph was a very sensible man, and so he more or less made him his prime minister. Everything Joseph did was in the name of Pharaoh. It was pretty incredible that an Israelite, as there wasn't even the word Jew then, should come to Egypt as a slave and end up being the number two in the country. But it was actually a very horrible culture in which Joseph was working. The Pharaoh had been brought up to believe he was a god. If he washed his face, the priest had to attend. Everyone had to watch. Washing the Pharaoh's face was a holy thing and must never be laughed at, must be watched. And exactly how he did it must be recorded because it showed how the country would work. If the Pharaoh got a headache, oh, that was a terrible omen. Great sacrifices must be made because if the Pharaoh had a headache, that must mean a calamity was going to come upon Egypt. It might sound comical to us, but that is truly what the pharaohs believed. Incidentally, that is why Moses angered Pharaoh so much when he said, God says, let my people go. And Pharaoh said, God who? I don't know your God. And anyway, I'm a God. How dare you talk to me like that? Joseph was living in an alien culture that had nothing to do with the God he worshipped, and yet God was using him to mould it into a way that helped people and showed people what kind of God he was. This is shown later in the Old Testament in the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah 29, you don't need to find it because I'm only going to read one verse. Jeremiah 29, verse 7. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of this city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. That's a very, very controversial thing to say. Not only are they in exile in Babylon, but they're in a culture where it's all wrong. Everything about it's wrong. They worship the wrong gods, they eat the wrong food, they don't have any kind of marriage laws that the Jewish people know about. They have no respect for anybody apart from the strongest person. If I can give an example, we've done this a few times when we looked at the last Frontline series. If I can give an example of just how unusual, how strange and how horrible this would have been for them. It's a little bit like a pastor being told that while the vicarage is renovated, he's going to have to go and live in the brothel next door for a week. Gasps. That would be such a terrible idea. No pastor in his right mind would want to do that. No Jew in his right mind would want to be stuck in Babylon. And that was where they were. And God says, seek the peace and prosperity of this city. And the response comes back, but I don't want to seek its peace and prosperity. It's horrible. I hate it. Can't I pray that it gets attacked instead? No. But, and of course the argument goes on. It's a perfectly reasonable argument. There are times when I wonder whether I've made the right choices in living in Britain today, as it becomes more and more pagan, and where spiritualism becomes more fashionable, New Age ideas become more fashionable. The whole Judeo-Christian value on which our country is built is being eroded. And it's very, very tempting to say, why not just let it fall to pieces, go to my church, worship God, pray to God, and it can all cave in around me because God will come back anyway. But God doesn't allow us to do that. A few weeks ago, I felt very strongly that God was telling me it was time to decide which political party I should support, and I joined the Green Party. The Green Party is not a godly party. In many ways, it's quite dark. I'm also a member of the trade union for journalists, the National Union of Journalists. That is not a godly place either. It's very dark. But I'm there because it's important that if something goes wrong, if people are being mistreated, there should be a group that cries foul. And if Christians aren't involved in that, are we really moulding culture? The Green Party supports the environment and asks for fair play to all, for all rather. It's a party that contains people who are LGBT, people who are sex workers. And surely, if Jesus were here today, on earth in a physical form, he would be in the middle of those people, not condemning them from afar, trying to witness to them, but refusing to go near them. It's not easy, and they'll probably try to throw me out when they discover they've got an evangelical Christian in the group who supports Israel. But until then, whatever happens, that's where God wants me to be. And whenever I've thought of leaving, he has given me four names. Joseph, who we've done, Daniel, Nehemiah, and Esther. All these people worked to change a horrible culture. Daniel was working for a king who could have your head cut off if he didn't like the dream you interpreted for him. Esther was working for someone who could have killed her because she'd walked into his presence without asking first and without being invited. The king could kill you for that. Nehemiah became the governor of Jerusalem and Judea because he was sad when he walked to the king carrying his cup. And as the king was meant to be a god, being sad in his presence, well, that could get you killed. Even in the Victorian times, where our country was hailed as a godly society, it wasn't godly. It was terrible. Children were forced up chimneys and down mines. The mentally ill were kept in hospitals where they slept on straw, and if you paid enough money, you could go in and laugh at them. Enter Anthony Shaftesbury, a Tory, an aristocrat, who believed that it was his responsibility to improve that kind of behaviour. For years, he said, the lot of the mental health must be improved. I insist on it being improved, and I'm going to make Parliament agree. For years, he said, you cannot call yourself a Christian country and force children up chimneys. It's satanic. You cannot force them down mines and make them work in horrible conditions. It's inhuman. And everybody said, but Shaftesbury, that's how we do things here. Maybe it's not nice, but you don't understand. It's our culture. That's how everything is done. We have to make children work for 12 hours a day. We can't give them 10 hours instead. That'll lose us money. We can't stop people going up chimneys. We have to clean them, and it's the easiest way. It's how we've always done it, for heaven's sake. You can't tell us to close those mines down. We'll lose money. Now, we don't have children going up chimneys. We don't have children going down mines. We don't have the mentally ill people, in hospital, being treated like circus animals. Does that mean our society is perfect now? Certainly not. We have a blame culture where we never apologise for things. We have a me culture where it's all about us. It's never about other people. Worst of all, we have a culture where morals are on the slide. But it's here where Jesus has called us to mould culture. Be fruitful so that your behaviour can change people. But David, I'm not Shaftesbury, or Esther, or Daniel, or Nehemiah or Joseph. I don't have a position like that. I just work in a hospital. I just work in a school. I just chat to people over the garden fence. All true. But how you work in the hospital, chat to people over the fence, and how you work in the school will influence the people around you, and that can mean things change. Maybe that just means writing a nice email where you're never nasty to people. And you may not even know that because you're doing that, other people are doing the same. Maybe it means you won't use foul language in front of people. And you may come to realise, or you may not even realise, that because you're not doing it, other people aren't doing it when you're around. And that will see an improvement in culture. And maybe you will never know how you are moulding culture. But I'm going to challenge us all this week, wherever we are, whatever we do, ask God for ways that we can mould our culture by the way we talk, the way we behave, the way we smile, or maybe just the way we think about other people and the way that thought is shown in what we do. I've said an awful lot here, and we're going to break for communion very soon. But before I do, I just want to give anyone the chance to ask or to respond or to challenge anything I've been talking about.